ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Alicia Simmons.
And I'm Lee Boucher.
As historians, we've spent years digging into the lives of people who've changed history, for better or for worse.
So naturally, we are extremely qualified to gossip about them.
And because they're dead, they can't sue.
In our podcast, we sift through Australia's most notable and notorious characters, giving you our unfiltered takes.
Find it by searching for The Dead Can't Sue on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal land. I'm David Marr. A show all about two American presidents. Later, the contradictory Thomas Jefferson, but first, the intriguing Donald Trump. 3 months ago, the New York Times published an astonishing story by its White House reporters, Jonathan Swan and Maggie Haberman, detailing the weeks of to and fro between Trump, Vance, Netanyahu, various American generals, U.S. intelligence chiefs and White House staff that led to Trump joining Israel's war with Iran. Secrets were revealed in every other paragraph, secrets that would be reported around the world. Like the director of the CIA telling Trump to his face that Israel's hopes for regime change in Iran were farcical, at which point the Secretary of State Marco Rubio added, in other words, it's bullshit. Yet the war happened. The New York Times told readers that the story was drawn from a soon-to-appear book by Swan and Haberman, Regime Change Inside the Imperial Presidency of Donald Trump, which hit the shops a fortnight ago. Since then, the authors have been flogging it to the world's media, reviews have been fabulous, and it's sold over 300,000 copies in a fortnight. We thought, however, that it was time here on Late Night Live to bring Jonathan Swan down to earth. After all, he's the Australian of the duo, son of Dr. Norman of the ABC, schooled at the Sydney Morning Herald, but now with 10 years' service in Washington, first with The Hill, then with Axios, where he did his Emmy Award-winning Trump interview, before joining the New York Times in 2022. Jonathan, welcome.
Thanks for having me, David.
Do you ever feel sorry for Trump? I mean, the poor guy can't even fix a soccer match.
I can't say I've felt sorry for him. Certainly not in the last 10 years.
Is it 10 years that you've...
Well, yes, it years. Is. This is my 11th... It's actually my 11th year of covering him consecutive. Yeah.
You and Maggie Haberman have
You feel sorry for me, don't you?
No, I don't. This is your professional This is your professional obligation. You seem to be fulfilling it quite well, Swan. And as a result, I think you're going to be hugely rewarded. You and Maggie have been cast in the role of interpreting this man to the world. It's a big task. You make the point in the book that it's not so much individual actions that reveal him, but pattern. What do you mean by that?
Well, Donald Trump, the man, hasn't really changed a lot. I mean, Maggie's covered him for more than 25 years. You know, she came up through the New York tabloids, and she wrote her first book was a biography of him, which talked about his times in New York. You know, the shamelessness, lie, double down, lie, try to create your own reality, make outlandish maximalist demands, and then kind of get pulled back, have enormous flexibility, be willing to completely reverse yourself, you know, from one day to the next, running your life in a very improvisational way, not having disdain for expertise. What's different about this term than last term is you're actually getting an expression of pure Trump. In the first term, it was diluted Trump. And, you know, for those of us who covered the first term, we would have these experiences of talking to very senior officials in the government, people who were in some of the most important roles, national security roles, other staffing roles, who the private conversations would be just dripping with contempt. You know, this guy is an idiot, he's dangerous, casting themselves almost in savior type roles, you know, protecting the republic, from Donald Trump, protecting the world from Donald Trump. None of that exists this term. He has a much tighter circle. People who believe in him, are loyal to him, defer to him, see their roles as implementers largely. And so you're really getting, like, I'll give you one example. Trump has wanted to do a broad scale tariff regime for many, many years. He's been talking since the 80s about how America's getting ripped off. In his first term, he had well-credentialed people from Wall Street like Gary Cohn, the former president of Goldman Sachs, almost grabbing him up by the lapel saying, do not do this. This is crazy. Do not do this. You will melt down the world, global economy. This time around, he took it for a spin. He started a trade war with the whole world last April. It didn't go very well. He pulled back. Ultimately, it was invalidated by the Supreme Court, but that took many months. But he tried it. And yep. You're seeing that play out on so many different in so many different areas.
I get the feeling from the book that this is a man who just simply loves exercising power, and the consequences of the exercise are secondary. Indeed, it seems that a great deal of the time he doesn't care what the consequences are.
I agree with the first part completely. I think Trump is addicted to both attention and power, and there is no more efficient delivery service for those things than the United States presidency. It's like the purest form of crack. And I think the come down after the first term was really enormous. When you are sitting in the dining room next to the Oval Office, you know, I've been in there in the first term, he's watching himself on television, right? And you see these, you know, all day he's watching, you know, going in and out, watching himself on television, watching the segments about him, reading about himself, making decisions very quickly that have world-shaking importance. I don't think it's, I wouldn't be quite as black and white to say he doesn't care about the consequences. I will say, though, he's much better at the announcement than at the follow-through. And what often you see is he'll make these grand announcements, these great huge policy declarations, and doesn't have the discipline or the patience to see them through. He's particularly ill-suited to diplomacy, particularly complicated diplomacy that takes a long time. So like last year, we have a lot of reporting in the book on the failed efforts to come to a deal with Iran, a nuclear deal with Iran. Trump fully empowered his envoy, Steve Witkoff, former real estate friend, to negotiate with the Iranians, but he didn't have the patience to see it through. And, yeah. You know, when you're talking about nuclear diplomacy with the Iranians, that's something that could take many, many months. We saw that in the Obama era. After a few months, wasn't very long, Trump went along with the Netanyahu bombing campaign last June. So that's a good example of how he doesn't really see things through.
Does he care about the consequences of this new kind of presidency that he's carved out for himself? Does he care that one day the powers that he has found will be exercised by a Democrat?
Oh, I don't get the sense that he's thinking about that in that way at all. Quite the contrary. I don't think it's possible to overstate how important the Supreme Court's decision in 2024 to confer sweeping immunity to presidents has been for this term. You know, Trump will say in private, I'm immune. All US presidents now have broad immunity for actions taken while in office. So very hard to imagine an action that Trump could take in office that he could be prosecuted for. So he has immunity. We also have reporting in the book that he's been saying privately to aides that he's going to pardon anyone who came within 250 feet of the Oval Office. Sometimes he says 200 feet, sometimes he says 25 feet, but there's some diameter, there's some radius around the Oval Office that's sort of a pardon zone. So Trump has immunity. Based on what he's told people, he plans to do sweeping pardons, maybe the most sweeping we've ever seen. He's richer than he's ever been. His family has made inordinate sums of money during this presidency. What's he got to fear? So I don't think he's particularly thinking about precedents or anything like that. I think he's just trying to establish himself as a capital G great man of history in this term and put his imprint on the world in Washington, and whatever comes next is whatever comes next. But I don't think he thinks that there'll be any consequences for himself.
Late Night Live, David Marr speaking to Jonathan Swan, one of the authors with Maggie Haberman of Regime Change, this extraordinary sort of history of the imperial presidency of Donald Trump as it is happening. I love the contradictions that emerge about Trump. He can be extraordinarily charming in your account, and he doesn't really like one-on-one conflict.
Yeah, and we sort of saw that come to life with us. So we'd been trying to get an interview with him for the book. I haven't had a proper sit down with him since the 2020 interview, which you mentioned in your introduction.
What did you say to him? He said to you, "You can't do that." And you said, "Well, why not?" Something like that. Was that the exchange?
Yeah. He was trying to explain to me how America was winning on death during COVID. And he handed me these statistics, and it took me a moment to figure out what he was trying to do. And anyway, needless to say, the way he was presenting them was very misleading, and I called him on it in the moment. Yep. Anyway, yep. I hadn't had
huge
a proper
enjoyment
sit-down.
Around the world for that moment. Thank you.
So anyway, we had done all our reporting for the book. We obviously, as a subject of the book, we want to do a proper interview with him. We didn't want to do there's a lot of reporters who are just, I mean, we all have his cell phone. You can just call him up anytime and have a sort of 3-minute conversation. It's pretty useless. Maggie and I don't really see value in doing that. We don't do it ourselves. You know, you just get 3 minutes of him telling you how everything's amazing. We actually wanted to do a proper sit down, with real questions, presenting scenes and reporting to him, giving him a chance to respond. Anyway, we didn't think he was going to grant it. It looked like he wasn't going to grant it. We certainly weren't getting any help through the front door of the White House. So ultimately, we just called him and asked, and he ultimately greenlit the interview. But 3 days before our appointment with him, he put out a post on Truth Social, his social media network, where he went on a rant about calls my co-author Maggot Haggerman, and he threatened to sue us. He's already suing the New York Times. He threatened to add us to the lawsuit. It was a long diatribe about mostly Maggie, but the whole thing. Anyway, the meeting isn't cancelled. We go in and see him, and he couldn't have been friendlier. He was relaxed, unhurried, showing us pictures of maple trees that he's buying for the yes. White House, showing us the ballroom that he's building and the columns and going through the architecture and this and that. The war it was like the 17th day of the war in Iran. It was the furthest thing from his mind. I mean, until we asked him about it, he was, was not on his mind. He was thinking more about interior design and architecture and what have you. So that wasn't surprising. Both of us have dealt with him long enough to know that's very much in character. He doesn't really like interpersonal conflict. He often switches from, brutal hostility to a charm offensive if he thinks he can sell someone on something. Very situational. He never closes the door. He never fully closes the door on anyone. Well, maybe not anyone, but just about anyone.
And
that's the way he is.
And he gave you a list of the most powerful men in history that he had beaten. This list, Jonathan, you've spoken about it and you've written about it, but some of the worst men in history were on that list. Stalin, Mao, etc. But he was untroubled by being in their company.
Yeah, it was pretty astonishing. We had some reporting that he'd been telling people that he was the most powerful American president that there ever has been. And we asked him about that. And instead of directly answering the question, he's got this aide called Natalie Harp, who...
She's quite a figure in the book, actually.
Yeah. So they call her the human printer. She's this young woman who used to work for a far-right TV network, very devoted to Donald Trump, joined him after he left office. She would follow him around with a portable printer and would print him good news stories to make him feel better during his really darkest time after losing office. We obtained for the book, I'm sorry, I'm going off on this detour, but just for context. So yep. We obtained in the reporting for this book personal letters that she'd written to him that were very unusual. She'd left them in some of his private areas, and the Secret Service was aware of them and somewhat alarmed by them. But, you know, they contained phrases like, "You are all that matters to me," right? So you get the idea. Anyway,
yeah.
By the way, I'm not suggesting anything was going on physically. It's a very unusual relationship of utter devotion. So anyway, she runs off and fetches this document for us, hands it to us. And he's sitting back and kind of watching us as we're reading it. He's like, he's reading it himself and we're reading it. And he says it's written by a historian and it says, you know, Donald Trump's the most powerful man who's ever existed on the planet. And then Trump says, and you know, he says, and Trump calls it the top 10. And it's, as you said, Hitler, Stalin, Mao, Genghis Khan, Attila the Hun, William the Conqueror, you know, all the great ones. And there was no dimension of morality to it. It wasn't a moral comparison. It was just the metric of raw power. And it was interesting because it was obviously written in quite a peculiar way. And we went down this rabbit hole. It turns out it wasn't a historian. It was a former golf caddy for Gary Player, a businessman. But the premise of the document, when you peel back, you know, sort of sort through all of this, was actually basically the premise of our book, which is that Donald Trump is using power in ways that no American president in my lifetime has used power. And in some respects, like no US president ever has used power. And Trump was delighting in it. I mean, he was completely untroubled. You know, he was like, "Oh, Napoleon, very interesting. You know, they keep power by fear, et cetera, et cetera." And it was sort of a little bit of a light bulb moment for me because I had been wondering, why does he seem to care so much less about domestic politics than he did in the first term? And when you look at it through the prism of that document and Donald Trump thinking, well, how am I the sort of one word, one name figure that we remember from this era of history? Well, in his mind, it's doing things like trying to turn Venezuela into America's 51st state. How do I conquer Greenland?
Still on the list.
There's no question. How do I bring about regime change in Iran, this problem that's bedeviled American presidents for 47 years? That's what, you know, he's willing to take so much more dramatic risks this term because he is quite detached from domestic public opinion. And he is playing for that, in his mind, great man of history position in this term.
Jonathan, I'm curious. You and Maggie left the Oval Office. You left the White House. You got clear of any snooping ears. What were the first things you said to each other, having seen that list, having been through that interview?
I'm pretty, at this point, unshockable when it comes to Trump, but I would say that was a moment where we were both rendered mute. it was one of those moments that we sort of were trying to process what we just experienced. Because he was very friendly, and then he sort of ended the meeting with this almost threatening, slightly too much mustard on it, but he said he was really addressing Maggie and say, "You write bullshit about me, you know, it's time you tell the truth."
Oh, he had a last little lash at you.
Yeah, just sort of threw it in there. And you know, so it was sort of, it was kind of, your head's a bit of a jumble. You're leaving the Oval Office, you've got this document comparing him favorably, I guess, to Hitler, Stalin, Mao, you know, whatever. And then you've got this sort of rattling around in your head, you know, the president of the United States has just told you basically you're a piece of shit and you better be nice to me.
Yeah,
you know, it's just a bit strange.
I get from the book that the White House, for Trump's purposes, the White House is working well.
For what he wants, absolutely. It's exactly the White House he wants, which is, if you're not in the room with Trump, you may as well not exist. He is the sun it is a president-focused presidency. Like George W. Bush, it was very process-driven. You had lots of interagency debate, you know, people from different government departments, experts getting in a room together, hashing it out. Very much the same in the Obama presidency. Donald Trump, it's like this country is being run by 5, 6, 7 people, and they're actually very secretive on issues that they really care about. That's how you get a situation where they went to war with Iran, and the two people in the US government who would be forced to handle the biggest energy shock in world history, the Treasury Secretary and the Energy Secretary, they weren't even in the room for the meetings that led to the led up to the war. They were brought in at the very, very last minute. And so I think people, again, still through a first-term prism, that this is sort of open kimono, you know, we see everything, it's very transparent. No, it's actually a performance of transparency. And you do have these big rolling meetings. He'll sort of theatrically invite a CEO in and whatever. And there are aspects where certain people have visibility into things that they shouldn't. But for the stuff that they really care about, they're actually very good at keeping secrets. And I don't think we even scratched this. I mean, we did our absolute level best in this book, killed ourselves on the reporting. I don't think we scratched the surface. I think there's 5% knowledge of what's going on just about everything. So it's a very challenging reporting task covering this administration.
Challenging but extraordinary. Now, we are both professional journalists, so Jonathan, I'm not going to ask you how you got your information. I am going to say that I was at first absolutely stunned by these private conversations that you are reporting in inverted commas, not just summaries, but in inverted commas. But after about...
Have you seen anyone deny it? Have you seen anyone deny it?
No, but after about 50 or 60 pages, I got kind of used to the fact that this astonishing level of reporting was just on page after page after page of this book. It reads like, and I'm wondering whether this was conscious in your writing of the book, it reads like the kind of book that is written 20 years after a regime falls, except the regime is in power now.
Well, it's kind of you to say that. That's exactly what we wanted to do. We wanted to give shape and depth in almost real time. That's why it was, this book almost broke me, like physically. It was the hardest I've just, and Maggie as well. That's what we tried to do. We obviously can't render judgments, you know, that are durable historical judgments about a presidency that's still unfolding. Who was it that said it? It was like 200 years after the French Revolution. It's too soon to say, you know.
Oh, yes, that old line.
You know, that old line. You know, of course we can't be rendering definitive judgments, but we can already tell, just based on what the president did last year, that this presidency is hugely consequential, that he's expanding presidential power in ways that we haven't seen in my lifetime. In some ways, we haven't seen full stop. And we just felt it was really important to try to get something out that goes deeper than daily journalism, but that we didn't wait until after the presidency, because I do think there's such a vital public interest in people being as informed as they can be about what's going on. So that was quite an unusual project that we embarked on here.
I wonder whether it is also, in a way, a portrait of America, because what you're cataloguing is the behaviour of a leader who still, despite having record disapproval levels at the moment, who is still backed by about a third of the nation. And what is it about America that they would elect this man, that they would support him in the way they have, and still, you know, to some extent, back him, despite everything?
I don't know that I can give a short sort of glib answer to that. It's so complicated. It's something that is both rooted in Trump's own unique characteristics and also in the conditions prevalent in America and also in his opposition. He's been so blessed by his opposition, just gifted by the Democrats. The Trump part of the equation is important, and I think his opponents or detractors often undersell or understate his own characteristics. I've never seen anything like the emotional bond that I've seen from Trump supporters with Trump. I've never seen it before. I can't remember who I was listening to, a historian of some stripe, talking about charisma and how it's often misused or misunderstood as a term. And it's often confused with charm, which is quite common. But charisma, properly understood, is very rare, comes along very rarely, and essentially means the power to compel someone to join a cult. I'm not reducing Trumpism to a cult. I think it's much more complicated and much broader than that. But the intensity of his bond with his base is so profound. And I just have this image in my head. I remember it was the end of the 2016 campaign, and it was like 1 a.m. and I was in this barn in Virginia waiting for Trump. And there was a crowd. It was cold. It was a crowd just snaking like a mile out of this barn. And Trump shows up late and he gets on stage and the crowd's exhausted, but then they're like re-energized. And there was this woman standing next to me. She's a black woman, and she had her toddler in her arms. And Trump was, he had gotten to the point with his audiences where it was like, he just needed to say a word and it was call and response. It was almost like a musician communicating with his audience. And, you know, he said Hillary Clinton. And so the crowd just spontaneously starts chanting, lock her up. And this woman was like almost crying and like bobbing her child and just saying, lock her up, lock her up, and looking at the child. And I just remember thinking, this just transcends any type of rational analysis or sort of anything you could put in a political science textbook. It's the X factor. And he has that.
Yeah.
He is a masterful mass communicator and brander and marketer. And he has a bond with his base that is really astonishing. And I just think that often gets understated in all of the analysis about Trump.
Is he going to be smashed at the midterms?
I don't know. It's basically macro issues, you know, the economy, how people are feeling about affordability, which is all against Trump, the war, he's very unpopular, he's alienated independence, versus the reality of a political map that has been drawn hugely to the Republicans' advantage. The gerrymandering has been so aggressive, run by one of Trump's top aides. And so the structural advantages are so overwhelming towards Republicans that there just aren't that many competitive seats in play. So it really has to be an enormous tidal wave election for Democrats to win lots and lots of seats. So I don't know. I'm not willing to, a lot of people saying, oh, it's going to be this huge blue wave. Maybe it might be. The conditions are certainly ripe for that. But Republicans have a lot of advantages.
Jonathan, look, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live. Tell me, I think my figures might be a little bit out of date, the 300,000 sales.
First week, mate.
Yeah, what's the more up-to-date figure for sales?
This sounds like I'm being obnoxious.
You can be obnoxious on Late Night Live.
They ran out of physical print. They didn't have the supply. So we've run into this situation where they're doing frantic restocking and reprinting, and I think we're into our fourth printing now. We sold 330,000 books in the first week combined in different formats, you know, audio, ebook, hardcover, print, which is the biggest selling first week of any nonfiction book in the United States this year, so far this year.
Yeah.
So it's crazy. I mean, it's like I was hoping it would find an audience. I wasn't, you know, banking on like 50 Shades of Grey kind of level of interest. But anyway, it's been good. It's been good.
And so you think, you know, on reflection, it was worth the pain, the strain, the exhaustion?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't say that with any like great certainty. It was like, it put a lot of stress on the family and everything. Like I was working 7 days a week for 3 years, you know, and for the last few months, 16-hour days, barely seeing my kids, you know. So, like, I'm being honest, it was just, like, it was hard. It was really hard. And, you know, I wasn't, like, in Fallujah under fire, but it was just very demanding reporting process, and I'm not eager to embark on something again.
You're welcome back here at any time. The door is not closed to you in Australian journalism.
You're the best, man. I'll be back on Late Night as long as you're here, David. That's
thanks,
all I
Jonathan.
Need. Thanks, Matt.
Off you go. I've been talking to Jonathan Swan, author with Maggie Haberman of Regime Change, Inside the Imperial Presidency of Donald Trump, one of the most astonishing books of contemporary politics I think I've ever read. Coming up, Thomas Jefferson and his problem with slavery. One of the great puzzles of the American Revolution, even today, 250 years down the track, is how Thomas Jefferson, author of the proposition that all men are created equal and endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights, including life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, how that man who wrote those immortal words could have owned hundreds of slaves, including four he fathered. Jefferson of blessed memory, third president of the United States, builder of Monticello, one of the most beautiful houses in the world, principal author of the Declaration of Independence, was deeply conflicted about race. His attempts to resolve that conflict in his lifetime is the subject of a new book, Jefferson's Wolf, a Founding Father's Troubling Answer to the Problem of Slavery, written by Krista Dierks-Heide, Professor of History at the University of Virginia, and Nicholas Guyot, Professor of North American History at Cambridge. And Nick Guyot joins me now. Welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you so much for having me on, David.
Now, Nick, Jefferson was 33 or 34 when he drafted the Declaration of Independence. He was a young man. Would he at that time have seen any contradiction between his life and his rhetoric?
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, the first thing I should say is that Jefferson grew up in late colonial Virginia, which was a place where slavery was utterly normalized. So it was kind of everywhere for a person like Jefferson. So his father had owned enslaved people. He himself inherited enslaved people when his father died. When he got married in 1773, his new wife owned enslaved people through her father. So slavery was everywhere. But at the same time, there was a movement that had been growing both in Europe and in the North American colonies to try to point out the contradiction, shall we say, between permanently holding people in slavery and Enlightenment ideas, so ideas about liberality and equality, and also religion, of course. So, you know, the golden rule, do unto others as you have them do unto you. So in a sense, in that moment in the 1770s, Jefferson's in this fix where slavery is everywhere in Virginia, but ideas, powerful ideas, both from religion and philosophy, seem to be suggesting that there may be a contradiction between slavery and the rights to which all human beings should be entitled. So that's kind of the backdrop to where he's at when he's writing the Declaration. But we should talk about the fact, I mean, all men are created equal. He did not mean that to include black people.
No. He was talking about his own people.
Yeah, I mean, again, I imagine many of your listeners will be able to relate to this. I mean, when one's thinking about why all men are created equal gets written down on that parchment paper in 1776, what Jefferson and the other founders of the United States are really arguing is that they, as white men, are equal to the white men in Britain with whom they've been in this political relationship for nearly two centuries. And in a sense, when Jefferson says all men are created equal, he's really saying the assembly in Virginia or the legislature in Massachusetts, they should be equal to Westminster. So actually, that's the kind of pitch of all men are created equal. He did not mean it to have a kind of universal understanding that would mean that black people or Native Americans or other peoples of color would be equal to white people. But the funny part is, I mean, even in 1776, a lot of people who heard him assumed that's what he meant. So almost from the beginning, this more expansive understanding of all men are created equal, which of course really would threaten slavery, sort of slipped its bounds in Jefferson's pen and began to take on a life of its own. And in our book, we kind of tell the story of the next 50 years of Jefferson's life and how he grappled with a phrase that other people wanted to mean more than he did.
He was carried away by his own capacity for poetry.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I think we really do need to go back 250 years and rediscover the momentousness and the radicalism of the American Revolution. So when you talk about poetry, in a sense, Jefferson needed the Declaration to be this sonorous thing, because what he was proposing which is that a set of European colonies on the other side of the Atlantic could break away from their imperial parent and declare themselves equal with what he called the powers of the earth. That hadn't happened before.
No,
and that was a big deal.
An almost unprecedented event.
Yeah, and I mean, in a sense, if you think about the way that Europeans thought about politics and about civilization, as they'd have called it back then, they didn't think that that could exist beyond Europe in any way that would resemble European nations. So many people in Britain or in France would see the colonies in America as places of slavery, as places of race mixing, as places of oppression. And in a sense, even though they had those imperial ties, the fact that that oppression and that race mixing was happening on the other side of the Atlantic enabled them to preserve their idea of civilization as European. So what Jefferson's trying to sell in 1776 is the suggestion that North America could be the site of a nation a lot like Europe. And this also explains his problems with slavery, right? I mean, one of the reasons that Jefferson begins to realize that slavery has to go is it's not moral or religious. It's that he doesn't think that European nations will accept the United States as an equal if 20% of its population is enslaved.
It has to be a white nation.
Well, that's the other thing, right? So again, not wishing to kind of like launder Jefferson here too much, it's that second part, not just getting rid of slavery, but also getting rid of black people themselves, which is connected to this Jeffersonian project of trying to make the new United States seem like it's the same as these European nations, one of these powers of the earth I mentioned before. So the crazy part about Jefferson's career after 1776 is not that he is an enslaver or not that he is ostensibly against slavery, but that he set an incredible bar on the project of getting rid of enslaved people from the United States, which is you need to remove them physically. You don't just need to free them. In fact, if you free them, you then create the obligation to get them out of the United States. And this is a side of the story I think most people don't know about Jefferson, and this is something that we explore in the book.
Yes, but I learned from your book that there was an attempt to deal with some of this in earlier drafts of the Declaration of Independence, but it never made the final cut.
Yeah, so the Jefferson basically wrote a much longer version of the Declaration. And then, I mean, anyone out there in your listenership who's ever written anything that's met an editor will know that terrible feeling of the editor taking out the knife and kind of, you know, filleting what you've written. And that did happen to the Declaration. But actually, the Declaration's original draft didn't contain any provisions for ending slavery or even for curbing the slave trade. However, Jefferson did criticize the slave trade. So this is the trade mostly in British vessels that's bringing new enslaved people into the North American colonies. He criticized it and basically blamed George III for having allowed that slave trade to continue when he and other politicians in places like Virginia have been trying to restrict it. So on some level, there's a kind of soft signal there that the Americans have been trying to control slavery and that Westminster and the king have been stopping them from doing it. And in a way, that's the way I'd think about it. Not that the Declaration had a kind of unfulfilled anti-slavery promise, but it's really about control. He wanted Jefferson and the other founders to be able to control the question of slavery, whether they kept it or whether they lost it. And that is very much something that George III and Parliament hadn't been able to give them or willing to give them before 1776.
How much of Jefferson's thinking about slavery and his actions and failure to act on slavery was dictated by the fact that his slaves were his wealth and he was, for almost all of his life, deeply in debt. He was not free to free his slaves.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good point. I might distinguish here a bit between his personal career as an enslaver and his political career, because you could argue that he's pretty disastrous at both. So he achieves almost nothing on the national political stage. And in fact, the institution of slavery gets much bigger across those last 50 years of his life after he writes the Declaration of Independence. I mean, he's going to live for another 50 years. He literally dies on July the 4th, 1826. It's a crazy coincidence. So there's exactly 50 years from when he writes the Declaration to his death. So in politics, he has very little success in curbing slavery. And in his private life, he does almost nothing to end slavery. And in fact, he frees barely a dozen people, most of whom are related to him through his relationship with Sally Hemings, both before he dies and then in his will. But I think the reasons for those two failures do look a bit different. I mean, we can get into them if you like, but the politics side of stuff, there's a whole set of obstacles because Jefferson has set this bar of getting rid of all black people. When it comes to the private staff, so those people that he kept at his amazing house of Monticello, there, I think you're absolutely right that his personal means were so bound up in enslaved people. He didn't ever have the financial headroom, if you like, to be able to create the kind of demonstration effect of freeing black people, which might actually have made a really big difference to the national debate about ending slavery.
What is Jefferson's wolf?
Well, this is kind of a crazy image which Jefferson comes up with in 1820. And he's basically writing to a congressman from Maine, from the state of Maine, in the midst of this big crisis which is brewing over whether or not the federal government should allow slavery to expand into the territory of Missouri. And again, those of your listeners that know a little bit about 19th century American history will probably know that one of the reasons we get a civil war in 1861 is not just because slavery still exists, but because the North and the South have been fighting over whether new states coming into the United States as it expands westwards should be slave or free. So in 1820, there's a big debate surrounding one of those western states, Missouri. And this congressman writes to Jefferson, who is then nearly 80 years old, in retirement at his big house, Monticello in Virginia. And the congressman says, please help us out. Give us some advice. What should we do with this debate? Should we let slavery go further to the West or not? And Jefferson writes back and he says, slavery is this incredibly tragic dilemma for Americans. And he says, slavery, it's like we have the wolf by the ear, not the ears. We have the wolf by the ear. We can neither hold him safely nor let him go. And actually, that's a sort of, for us, really crucial phrase to think about, not only because it demonstrates that Jefferson is also thinking about security. So one of his other reasons for being anxious about keeping people in slavery is his fear they will rebel, which is a big, big, big driver for him. But also that weird second part. So I understand if you've got a wolf, you can't hold him safely and he's thrashing around. But when it comes to freeing black people from slavery, why would you imagine that they would then be really dangerous? Wouldn't you think that freeing them would alleviate or remove that danger that they would rise up against you? So actually, it's that idea of black freedom as threatening, which we really try and explore in the book.
Yes, yes. And you argue in the book that actually they'd be rather grateful to be freed. They might quite like you for freeing them. But how much do you think his fears were formed by watching at quite close range the massive slave uprising in San Domingo?
Yeah, I mean, what became the Haitian Revolution, which starts in 1791 and ends in 1804 with the Declaration of Independence in Haiti, which is in some ways modeled on the US Declaration of Independence, fascinatingly. That's the largest slave revolt in human history. It's incredibly bloody. The French make several efforts to try and put it down and get the colony back. We go into this in a book because it's so interesting that Jefferson is both kind of terrified and excited by the Haitian Revolution. So he's terrified by it because it seems to bring into focus all of these fears that eventually, if you leave enslaved people for long enough, the slumbering volcano will erupt and every white person will be consumed by it. But he's also excited by the Haitian Revolution. And this is the crazy part, because he begins to think if Haiti becomes independent under a black-led government, so the first black-led independent government anywhere in the Western Hemisphere, then maybe that government will agree to take enslaved people from the United States if they're freed by the federal government or by the states. So he actually brings up this idea of Haiti both as a kind of terror in the night, but also as a potential savior, as a kind of receptacle for 500,000 or more black people who are in slavery in the US that he wants to free on condition of getting rid of them.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr. I'm talking to Nick Guyatt about his book in which he addresses the deep contradictions in Jefferson's life over race. Nick, his argument was, we free them, but they have to go. And you make the point that that was a widely held view in the new country.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of bonkers. In fact, Lincoln in 1861 comes up with this crazy plan to try and buy a colony in Panama. Do you know the story, David? It's nuts. Lincoln.
It sounds
basically
so modern, Nick.
I mean, so well, precisely. I mean, it does sound very Trumpian. So Lincoln basically gets money from Congress to buy a space in Panama with the proposal that black people will be freed, so who are enslaved still, 4 million slaves at that point, they'll be freed and they'll be sent to Panama in freedom, but to work in the coal mines. He also buys an island off the coast of Haiti, where he's in 1863, incredibly, where he's also planning to try and resettle black people. So I would say pretty much every politician, certainly every major politician who was not committed to permanent slavery, all of them who are committed to gradual emancipation, believe that what they call colonization, the removal of freed people from the US, was the way to go. So it's bizarre to me that we've sort of lost track of the fact that so much of this opposition to slavery in the early United States was premised on removing black people from the new republic.
One of the ways that good-hearted slave owners showed that they were, in some senses, reasonably decent people was when they died to free large numbers of their slaves. But Jefferson did not do this.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to throw the work blanket at you here. I mean, good-hearted and slave. I mean, I know what you mean, but
I'm struggling for words here about.
Well,
let's
take that at face value, and let's say you're absolutely right that one of the things that enslavers wanted to be was heroes of their own movies, right? Like,
yes,
that genuinely,
yes.
They thought of themselves very much in that context of being the kind of people that they would want others to judge positively based on their treatment of their slaves. And
gallant.
Actually, it is a bit of a... Yeah, well, it's kind of a minefield now because you very often get, I mean, especially like telly historians, so people that perhaps, you know, pop up on the TV telling stories about history, you will interview someone and say, was he a good slaveholder? And the answer is no, there were no good slaveholders. However, I think you're absolutely right that one of the ways in which that liberality or largesse was performed by enslavers would be by trying to free enslaved people in their wills. But here again, it's fascinating. I mean, neither Jefferson nor Madison, you would see as the two, I think, most important and most significant founding fathers, neither of them freed enslaved people in their wills. Washington did, but a large number of enslaved people belonged to his wife, so she retained those after he died. And for Jefferson, the reason he didn't do it, I think partly he knew that he would not be able to arrange the deportation or the removal of those enslaved people with their consent, but also because he was massively in debt. And I mean, you know, another story we tell in the book is that basically he owes about $100,000 when he dies. His enslaved people's value is somewhere in the $30,000-$35,000 region. So his creditors are like, you basically, we're going to need an auction. So in fact, there is one that takes place at the beginning of 1827 in January. And you have all of these enslaved people that have always, always refused to countenance the idea of leaving and going to another country, finally sold and scattered. So Jefferson gets the scattering of his enslaved people, but not in freedom to a new country, but in slavery to the Deep South or to the West. So it's a terrible story.
And then there is the long campaign to deny the fact that Jefferson had children with one of his slaves. And
And
who was fighting that, and what was it about?
Well, I mean, I do think so. One thing you might say is, how on earth is it possible for Jefferson to be having sex with Sally Hemings potentially for decades, and for him still to refuse to free enslaved people, both her and eventually the children they had together? And in the book, one of the things we talk about is that actually, even before he began having sex with Sally Hemings in Paris in 1789, when he was the US ambassador to France, when she was only 15, I should say, and he's in his 40s. Even at that point, Jefferson, I think, had already said that it was terrible that so many white Virginian enslavers, especially young men, were having sex with enslaved people. And another reason to get rid of slavery was because of the licentiousness and the kind of indolence that it was encouraging.
Oh, dear
so
God.
Actually, well, yeah, so actually it's kind of, and we talk about this a bit in the book, it's kind of nuts to think that in some ways, when Jefferson began forcing himself on Sally Hemings, he was able in his own mind to style himself as a victim. by which I mean the proximity of young enslaved women to men like him could be seen by him as the reason that he had lost his self-control. So it's kind of, again, it's to my kind of mind, both tragic and awful that the Sally Hemings kind of sexual encounters that he was having didn't persuade him for a moment that he might be wrong about getting rid of black people. Instead, it persuaded him that he'd been right all along. So yeah, I mean, the whole American history establishment for the longest time attempted to deny that this relationship with, I mean, shouldn't call it a relationship, this sexual kind of, we should call it concubinage, that's the best word. She was his concubine. But that relate, that dynamic between them, for the longest time, American historians had denied it. But from the very beginning, it was Sally Hemings' children with Jefferson who went public about it. So yes. Her son, Madison Hemings, in 1873, gave this interview to a newspaper guy saying, yeah, this is what happened. This is who Jefferson was. He's kind of a cold fish. He was my father. And the fascinating thing, David, is that African-Americans kept this story of Jefferson's black family alive across a century and a half in which most white historians, and of course the official historical establishment, was trying to deny it. And it was only in 2001 that the Jefferson Foundation at his house Monticello finally came out and accepted the DNA evidence that demonstrated it was a settled fact that Jefferson had these black children with Sally Hemings. So that story was always known by black people, but it was very, very hard for white people to accept it.
An impossible question, Nick, to end. Do you nevertheless, in some way, admire this man?
Well, let me flip that around and say that I think in a way, so we've talked almost exclusively about Jefferson, what's going on in his head, what he did. What I really want to emphasize to close is that Jefferson is not the only person in this story. He is talking to so many other people in his historical moment who see this story differently than he does. He's talking to his enslaved people. You know, he's left us 60,000 letters or so in his correspondence. So there's a massive, massive volume of material there about just how often he was conversing with the people he enslaved. He talked with anti-slavery campaigners who are white and black. He talked to Virginians. He talked to French people, to Brits. All of those people provide us with a sense of the kind of moral headroom of his moment and actually also help us to assess the gulf between some of his higher ideas and his actions. And all I would say, David, is what's fascinating about this story, this moment in American history, is not Jefferson's genius or Jefferson's villainy, but the idea that this brilliant man had this idea about getting rid of black people, and in his own historical moment, he lost the argument. He lost it practically and intellectually. People wrote to him and said, this is a mad idea. Black people refused to go. Politicians wouldn't put the legislation on the books. So in some respects, I think capturing the true kind of meaning of the story is not just about focusing on Jefferson. It's about focusing on all those other people who, as I said at the beginning, could imagine a meaning for all men are created equal, which he never intended.
Yes, but he left those words. But those words are there.
And they inspired others. They inspired others in his moment, is my point. I mean, there's a Massachusetts preacher called Lemuel Haynes, who from the very, very first months after the Declaration is invoking all men are created equal to say that slavery must end. There's the black mathematician Benjamin Banneker in the 1790s who writes to Jefferson and says, hey, you wrote all men are created equal. That must mean you oppose slavery. There are all these wonderful stories we try and tell of people. Yeah, but who are inspired exactly as you suggested by what Jefferson wrote. And I think, I mean, maybe that's a good place to end. I mean, it's a reminder that sometimes the things people write can be bigger and better than they are.
Nick, thank you very much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thanks so much, David.
I've been talking to Professor Nicholas Guyatt, who, with Krista Dix-Heide, has written this book, Jefferson's Wolf, A Founding Father's Troubling Answer to the Problem of Slavery, just published by Harvard University Press. And that's the show. On our next, I'm sitting down with Gamilaroi singer, songwriter, performer and elder Roger Knox to talk life, country, his 50-year career, and the songs he's singing now about his family and people.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.